You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
This is Research for the Real World. Conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to shape our everyday lives.
This is Research for the Real World, conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to help shape everyday lives. Hello, I'm Jo Nicol, a science education lecturer and a PhD researcher at IOE's UCL's Faculty of Education and Society. This is my first time presenting this podcast, so there is a mix of excitement and a little bit of nerves from me right now. In this season of Research for the Real World, we want to focus on climate change and development education and how education systems can be reimagined to embed sustainable development principles and practices to bring about a positive change and climate justice. So on this episode, I am delighted to be talking to Professor Doug Bourne. Professor Doug Bourne is the director of the Development Education Research Centre. He has been a professor of development education since 2017. He was the editor of the International Journal of Development Education and Global Learning and has been a member of a range of government advisory panels and working groups, including being on the Sustainable Development Education panel. He is the chair of Global Learning London. He was the course leader for the MA in Development Education and Global Learning. And his book, Understanding Global Skills for the 21st Century Professions, was published in 2018. He has a new book out, published in 2022, entitled Education for Social Change. Doug, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jo. Look forward to the conversation.
Me too. Okay, I'm going to start with asking you, well, just to get to know you a bit better, how did you become involved in education?
Well, it takes me back a long time. I suppose my starting point in education was that after I finished my degree at Keio University in History and Politics, I then went on to do a PhD at the same university on sort of development of Labour Party ideas on education, which is really looking at the role that education could play in change in society. And so from that, I suppose all my working life, my careers has been involved in education in a number of different ways. I trained to be a teacher, but in the end didn't go into the teaching profession, but ended up working for a youth organisation and then a number of other organisations. And in 1993, I founded the Development Education Association, which was an umbrella body for promoting learning about global and international development issues in England. And that was sort of how my involvement in education has been quite long term. But it's very much been on influencing what's happening within education rather than saying delivering things within the school context.
Yeah, it feels to me as though there's a lot of initiative there around sort of the political element as well, especially if you studied your undergraduate degree there. Fantastic. What was your teaching degree in, by the way?
I'm a teacher. I'm going to be to teach history and geography. So I did a little bit of that. Then I got a chance to work in other organisations and charities. So I took some of that learning and skills from that. And one of the things I found was that some of the skills that I developed and trained to be a teacher become very valuable in working for charitable organisations, particularly when you're running training courses and so on. There were similar sort of skills that you might want to need. So I've sort of continued that sort of engagement, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so many skill sets that you get as a teacher that you can apply to elsewhere, and they're really, really useful. Tell us a little bit about how did you come to the IOE?
Well, that's a rather strange experience. So I've been running this organisation, Development Education Association, for 13 years. And it was a time when there's considerable political support and government support for the field I'm engaged in, which is sort of development education and learning about global issues. And there's a considerable amount of funding available from then what was called the Department for International Development. And I was very closely working with civil servants in that department and with government ministers who were asking questions about, so what's the impact of your work? Well, how do you know that this area of work is having impact within schools or wider society? And I was often given talks about these areas to policymakers or to practitioners. And to be honest, I was almost talking off the top of my head because I didn't really have the evidence and the answers to ask questions. How do you know whether this is having an impact? For me, it's just seen as a good thing and that was valued and so on. So I started a conversation with civil servants at the Department for International Development and said, I think we need some body of research and evidence to measure the impact of this work and so on. So they said, yeah, that's a good idea. Do you want some money to set up a centre? So what happened was, in the process of dialogue with people in government and also with colleagues at the Institute of Education, we came up with a funding proposal and funding agreement. And so I brought the money that I'd obtained from UK government to IOE, of course, with open arms. That was bringing quite a large sum of money, I don't know, at that stage, about £500,000. So, and that's how it came. So I came initially seconded from the organisation I was working for and then came to work full time at the IOE. So it was an unusual process and not the traditional one of applying for a job and so on. It was just that, here you are, here's some money. Do you want it? Okay, let's work out a way how we can deliver it.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's very rare. I've never even heard of it that way around. I've just finished actually the Early Career Impact Fellowship. And it's really interesting. You were kind of almost working it from the opposite direction of which I was, which was trying to use the research from my PhD findings to then use them to have impact in society. And for me, that was a really interesting journey because I felt I'd done all this reading and I found out some really interesting stuff. And then I needed to see that and show that the things that I found out actually meant something. Whereas from your perspective, it's kind of the opposite way around, right? Where you've got these things that you're doing, you know that they're having an impact, but actually you need the evidence and the research to show it. And what made you choose the IOE? Or was there a way in which that collaboration was happening before?
So that collaboration was happening before. So in my previous job, the Running Development Education Association, we'd had a number of lectures that we'd organised at IOE. We'd had a couple of conferences that we'd organised at IOE. And there were two or three professors who I knew well who had been involved in some of the things I've been doing. So it was a natural organisation to move to work with.
The fact that you're still here says a lot as well, doesn't it? The fact that that centre's been running for a long time, I think it speaks for itself, the work that it's doing. And you have a lot of still links with government?
Not really, not so much the current government. Some small scale links with our civil servants, but much less so since 2010. And some of that was under the Labour government times. There was a lot of money for this area of work. At one stage, $24 million a year for funding civil society organisations in this field. But all that money went from about 2012 onwards. There was a couple of programmes that government continued to fund, which I was very closely involved in. The most important one was one called the Global Learning Programme, which was coordinated by Pearson Company with a range of other organisations, and I was responsible for leading on the research and development phase of that programme. And then the successor programme to that, the UK government funded through the British Council, called Connecting Classrooms Through Global Learning, I was one of the advisors to that programme. So there was a continuation of that, but the amount of funding and support from UK government decreased dramatically. And now we've got this stage where actually in 2022, there's now no money. And UK is now regarded as one of the few countries in Europe that does not fund this area of work, compared with 20 years ago when it was regarded as being the leading country in Europe. So there's been a dramatic change in that, which has obviously had some impact upon what I do and what our centre does, but we've had to adjust to a changing political climate and so on. But yeah, so it's been a rather different world when I started out and setting up the centre in 2006.
In the IOE, working at the IOE, you're obviously thinking about the teaching side of things. You led for quite a number of years, didn't you, the MA in Development Education and Global Learning, right? So you've had lots of, I guess, experience with the students over the years.
Yes, I have. Yeah, it's rather odd though, because when we came to the IOE, there were three things we had about setting up the research centre. One was development of community researchers, one of which was establishing the academic journal we set up, and the third one's to establish the first ever master's programme. And we took the very brave decision when we launched the programme in 2008 for it to be a distance learning program, an online program, which at that stage was very rare and very unusual. But we did that because we felt that our student cohort was going to be global. We wanted it to be global from all around the world. And also we wanted to test out whether that would provide different and more innovative pedagogical approaches to just having face-to-face teaching. And I think we've been very successful in that. We've adapted the program over a number of years. But it was a real step into the unknown, I think, when we set up the program. Mm-hmm. And I think the sense in which, whilst we got to know lots of students, I wouldn't say we really got to know them personally, certainly at a master's level. And that was rather strange. But that's one of the things I think we've learned from the process, how to engage people and not necessarily on your doorstep.
Yeah, I think I wish I had this conversation before COVID hit and I was running my MA and trying to think of all these ways in which I could connect with these students from thousands of miles away. And it was really difficult to go from that face to face, you're right, to be such a distance learner. I mean, from that, you surely have brilliant ways in which you've been able to think of connecting with those students across the world.
Yeah, and I think, but students themselves are used nowadays, the sort of the digital age in which we now live and work in, that people have set up their own forms of contacting people and so on. So that's evolved, I think, in terms of pedagogically and technically, it's been a very steep learning curve for all of us. And I think we have found at times challenging to come up with ways that weren't just reproducing what was happening on a face-to-face basis online. And I suppose a key thing we tried to do was to have activities on our master's program, which are very much based around group-based discussions that were done online. They're asynchronous, so they could do that in their own time. And have that sort of building process rather than going along and listening to a lecture. But what's been interesting more recently, we've started to bring in online lectures in a small way into some of the activities because we feel students are looking for a range of experiences as part of the learning process.
Yeah, the online lectures definitely ring a bell with me. And I guess that idea of the discussions that you're getting the students to engage in on Moodle and even amongst themselves or with you present, it means that they've got a voice there, isn't it? You're learning from them as much as they're learning from you.
Very much so. And I think one of the things we've done a little bit of recently is done some bit of research about what we learned from sort of distinctive pedagogical approaches, because our program and our whole approach to development education global learning is to present the learner with a range of voices and perspectives, which they then critique and assess and come up with their own ideas from that process of learning. So, and that having that process has worked really well. What's been really interesting is that our cohort of students has been incredibly diverse. So you've had some students who are teachers in schools in the UK, some are teachers in international schools overseas. We've had people who've worked for businesses and companies, some people are working in further and higher education, people work in the media. But I suppose above all, what I've found is that vast majority of the students have done our master's program have done it because they want to change the world, right? They want to make the world a better place. And also some of the sort of more incidental things that have come out of it is that people have said, as a result of doing your MA, I've rethought what I want to do. It might be I don't want to be a teacher, I want to work for an NGO, or it might be the other way around. It's led to people rethink what they're trying to do and what they want to do in their future lives. And to me, that's a sort of product of our success. If it's students to rethink what they're about and what they're doing, then I think that's a healthy sign, because that's what master's programs should be all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a powerful way to engage the students. You've got this cohort of people who want to change the world and are invested in it to the point where they're doing a master's about it.
So often one of the challenges comes at the end of the program, where sometimes I have conversations with students about, so what are you going to do next? And I think those are sorts of things that sometimes become increasingly difficult in recent years, because some of those openings they might have had for career development have gone, or the opportunities have narrowed. And I think that's been quite, for a number of them, that's been quite frustrating about what they want to do and where they want to be teaching.
In terms of sort of being an educator yourself and working on a daily basis and thinking about issues such as the climate crisis, those issues can be perceived to be quite depressive at times, can't they? And quite a big concern for all of us. I know for myself, even just having two young children, sometimes when I sort of switch and think about the future a little bit too much, it's frightening, isn't it? And it is definitely a pang of panicking me when I think about that.
Yes, it is. And I think, and that's where I suppose some of my more recent writing work around this concept of a pedagogy of hope and how we address those concerns has become important. I suppose I would start by saying that as educators, whatever field of education we're working in, we have to promote our positivity in what we do. If we're giving off negative vibes, we're not going to be successful at what we're doing. So we have to be positive. We have to promote a sense of enthusing learners and to encourage them to believe that they can make a difference and make the world a better place. And so to me, it's therefore important as the educator to come with that mindset. Therefore, when you're faced with challenges that we have around us, whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's COVID, whether it's the current economic crisis or the war in Ukraine, there is a sense that you have still go through that and create a sense of positivity that you can contribute to that. And that's where your skills and knowledge become so important. And also feel you use your own personal backstory as a way of helping that process, because about saying you've done this and you help this so you can achieve this. But I think that to me is sometimes a skill and approach that as educators and even a place at IOE, we don't discuss enough. We as educators instill a sense of positivity, a sense of hope in what we do and how we teach. I've been involved in two or three conversations and seminars at IOE around eco-anxiety, particularly amongst younger children, and concern about the future, right? My response to that is you have to understand why is that sense of hopelessness and despair. You've got to address that. But you've also then got to flip it over and say, okay, so what are we going to do about that? And it's not about saying, well, you can't change things, but you have to say, well, everyone can make a difference, whether it's small scale or locally or whether it's on a big scale. And I think that we have to bring in those connections. So to me, if you're teaching about climate change, for example, and the climate crisis, you've also got to bring in how you address that sense of feeling of helplessness and feeling of despair. And you've got to bring in that sense of positivity and that change is possible. And there is examples where change is happening. Because if you're not doing that, you're falling short of equipping learners with the skills and knowledge they need to have. And I think sometimes that's often missing. Often it's just the bits of knowledge they need to know about without actually saying the development of skills and also a very strong values base that they themselves can make a difference and they have a sense of social justice and concern and a sense of social responsibility.
But how do we present to them issues that aren't too far gone when they're hearing the narrative a lot of the time? If we don't get to this certain temperature, how do we do that, Doug? Tell us.
Not easy, but I think you've got to tell the whole story, right? So in other words, if you're starting to address that there are these challenges, you've also got at the same time talk about the stories of people and communities around the world who've addressed these things and secured change at a local level. You can't do one without the other. And that may often be difficult in a lesson or something like that. But I think you've got to have that as your goal, because that shows the sense of what you can do in terms of making a difference. Also, you've got to address things at different age groups in slightly different ways. And so, you know, for example, I would say, particularly with younger children, the sense of creating some values base around empathy and caring and making a contribution to the world that you have a right to have a voice, you have a right to be listened to. I've become very influenced by a lot of the conversations recently around children's rights by a body like UNICEF, and the sense in which you are how you bring those things in to discuss around climate justice, climate change, and sustainability in general. And that to me is where, as educators, we need to develop the skills to do that. And sometimes those things are not easy. And I think we ought to give more attention to that in terms of how we go about equipping our future teachers to engage in the challenging issues they're going to be faced with in the future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, my PhD research that I'm doing is ultimately pushing for this more empathetic, values-based science education, whereby we really are sort of assessing and promoting children to value the world beyond an anthropocentric ideology, right? So we're not just thinking about humans being at the center of it, but having that responsibility to want to help others and to help ecosystems and things that are all involved in that complex. Yeah. It's really important. And I guess in that sense, you create flourishing individuals if you do that, don't you, that want to help and care for the environment rather than this, like you say, eco-anxiety children which feel helpless.
Yes. So, for example, in my sort of field, over the last decade or so, the term global citizen and promoting a sense of global citizenship has become very trendy and very popular, and rightly so. But there's been this more recent discussion, influenced particularly by educationalists and community organisations in Latin America, that talks about, which you've used in the term planetary citizenship, that talks about the interconnectedness of people and nature and the earth. And bear in mind that for a lot of indigenous communities in Latin America, that's where the whole process of who they are and how they see the world has come about. And I think there's something in that. And I think the sense in which how we can bridge this sense of how we want to be a global citizen, have a sense of global social responsibility, yet at the same time recognizing our connections to the earth and to the planet. Because all too often, they've often run in my area of work on parallel lines and haven't intertwined enough and connect enough. And so to me, I think we need to come up with a language, some tools for learning that bring those things much more closer together. And I think we have a lot to learn from communities around the world where that understanding and engagement with nature and their protection of their natural environment is part of their everyday life and everyday being. And I think we could learn a lot from some of those communities.
Absolutely. There's a lot of work in science education going on in terms of appreciating and valuing and recognising the value of those indigenous communities and the way that they view the world. It can be really powerful. And I love that term that you use, planetary citizenship. I've not heard that before. I think I'll be using that again. Thanks. And yeah, I guess thinking and keeping on with that theme about global issues or returning to it, what questions should the development, education and global learning community, what questions should they be posing within these global issue debates, do you think?
I think the sorts of questions, some of them relate to what I've just been saying, the sense that actually, the sense of positivity, that change is possible. There's a sense that actually engaging in learning should be connected to some form of social engagement. I don't necessarily mean just some form of direct social action. I mean that actually they take some sense of social responsibility. So I think the community that I'm part of, I think, sees its contribution to, say, the current debates and the climate crisis is actually those areas, how you bring in this concept of global citizen, planetary citizenship, and recognition of different voices around the world, and that you see these things as interdisciplinary, which also means that if you're a science background teacher like yourself, how that connects to people who might be history teachers or citizenship teachers, how do you bring some of those things together and how do we learn from each other? And that's where sort of our community that I'm involved with comes from, is actually look at how we can join things up much more, how we can learn from each other. And I think that's really, very important. Also, I think I would say is that this whole field needs to put social and environmental justice much more at the heart of what it's about. Very interesting, you talk to educationalists in various parts around the world, when they talk about climate change, they talk about environmental justice, and they don't just mean the natural environment, they mean the environmental justice of where people live and how they live in the local communities. And I think some of those things need to be much more brought out. And of course, that approach doesn't necessarily resonate with the current political thinking in this country about how they see climate change education. But to me, okay, just because that's not where maybe seen within the Department for Education doesn't only mean as teachers and educators you shouldn't be doing it. we have a right to have our voice heard and a voice to have our perspectives listened to. And I think you'll find that more and more young people we want to hear about the sort of perspectives that we're talking about, because it connects their own sense of concern and how you turn that sense of powerlessness into a sense of hope and positivity.
This leads me actually into your work on our Shared World Coalition. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. So one of the things that's come out of lots of conversations over the last few years has been that when the Sustainable Development Goals were launched in 2016, I think it was, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, within those goals, there was a goal 4, which was related to education. And within that was a specific target called Target 4.7, which was around how to promote learning that connected the environment with development, with human rights, with social justice, with gender and peace and human rights. And there was a sense in which what that target was calling for was these themes to be embedded within all sectors of education and learning in all ages around the world. And that led to a number of organisations coming together in England who were saying, well, how can we ensure and lobby government and policymakers and practitioners to recognise this target and these goals and to make them more central to what's happening within the school classroom? And that also means you're making connections in the learning between environment and social justice, between human development and natural nature and so on. And we found that what was interesting was that a large number of organisations, civil society organisations, small-scale local ones and big national organisations like Oxfam and World Wide Fund for Nature were thinking the same things. About 3 years ago, we came together under this umbrella called Our Shared World Network, Our Shared World Coalition, that had no money or very little money, but people put their own time and energies into how we can promote learning about these issues in areas of education in England, particularly to focus on the national curriculum. So I was brought in to work with a colleague from Bath Spa University, Jenny Hatley, to find out what was happening within education within schools in England and how that compared with what's happening elsewhere in the world, about how these themes related to Target 4.7 were being reflected within the education system in England. So we produced this report that we published as a Development Education Research Centre report earlier this year. And what was very interesting about that report was we find a lot of areas of engagement amongst schools, amongst civil society organisations in a lot of these things, but they tend to be rather episodic and very specific, often almost in a silo, in a box. But yet underneath them all, lots of the conversations that people are having, well, this is posing wider questions. So what is the purpose of education? How have we lost sight of its social purpose? And that enabled conversations to be made with organisations, with teachers, that connected discussions about climate change and climate justice with the impact of the pandemic and people working and teaching from home. It's made connections to more recent events, like the war in Ukraine and so on. And so there's a sense in which that coalition has touched a lot of buttons that people were very conscious of about what we need to do. Now, of course, it's an even bigger task. So how do you then take these things forward? But there's evidence, I think, that teachers and schools in England are looking for these sorts of examples of things to inspire them, to give them that sense of confidence and belief that these things are important, that they are connected, and that they, as teachers, can enthuse their learners to make a difference. So we just have to wait and see as to how that goes forward, really.
Wow. And is it primary schools and secondary schools, the curriculum?
Yeah. So it was an enormous piece of work. So we looked at some of the themes like human rights and peace, environment, global citizenship and so on, but tried to see how they came together, right, and looked at evidence from research papers, but also what they were telling us about, okay, we want, about why we're engaged in teaching, what we're trying to do with this teaching, what's its purpose. And I think what we found is that it what wasn't being brought out enough was actually what people were doing. They were looking for reasons to actually why this should be seen as important beyond just saying, wow, we've got to address the climate crisis because it's there, right? And I think that to me has said something that we need to do much more with. And I'm very conscious of my own work, that I've got to think much more about how I can provide support, or my centre can provide support to teachers and educators, to engage these issues, to give them the sense of confidence that these things are all interconnected. 25 years ago, I was writing about the importance of globalisation in terms of the impact upon education. You don't have to talk about that anymore because it's so evident. In the same way, I think sustainable development and climate change now is so there and so evident. But actually what people need to know is, what does this mean for me, and what's my role in terms of engaging with these issues beyond just a sense of, it's just something else I need to know something about.
How can we ensure schools teach a diverse range of perspectives and histories concerning climate change and development? I know you've touched upon some of these ideas already, but if there's anything else.
I think the sense in which teachers themselves, I think, need to be exposed to a range of voices and perspectives in their own professional development. One of the things that I was involved with a lot of research 10 years ago was how schools in this country could encourage having partnerships and collaborative projects with schools from elsewhere in the world, and the sense in which encouraging that mutual learning. Now, sometimes that can end up being very paternalistic, but I found a lot of evidence that our children in one part of the world learning about an issue, the same issue from another part of the world, they got different perspectives on things. To me, that sense of encouraging teachers and schools to have that global outlook, having the outlook that how do we ensure that children get equipped with a range of perspectives, they learn about things from different people and different communities. So people maybe from local communities brought into school to talk about their own experiences. That to me is about making things real and how those things connect with people. And to me, that is one of the ways that you can make things much more engaging, because to me, it goes back to what these podcasts are all about, is about real world experiences. How do we make them part of people's everyday lives? And I think that to me is how you do that, by bringing people's stories, people's experiences, and how they share that. And so you say, well, okay, what do we do with this? What have we learned from this? And how can we then use that in our own personal social development?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think what a great idea to have kind of these similar scenarios, or same scenarios, but gain a different perspective from it, from someone else in some other part of the world. In terms for you, Doug, what's next for you? I know you've had a long career in this area. What do you think's next?
Well, one of the things I find quite difficult is to say no when people come up with ideas for publications or pieces of work. And so at the moment, I'm involved in three major publications, which are a result of some work and conferences and materials that I've been involved with. So a book that I've edited with a colleague from a university in Bologna, we've got this book we're editing out around this theme of hope, pedagogy of hope and global social justice, which is a series of chapters based on voices from a range of people all around the world. And that will be out next year. The second book that I'm working on, which I think I'm really quite proud of, which is trying to bring together examples from research of doctoral students that I either supervised or was involved in examining or had some personal connection with. And that we're just about to complete that, and that'll be out next year as a book called Research in Global Learning. And the reason that is important is I think that takes me back to how I came to set up the centre in 2006, which is actually what we need is bodies of evidence, bodies of research that demonstrate the value and the contribution in this area. So this book will have 15 chapters of former doctoral students from all over the world. We have them all come to our university from all over the world. So that I'm particularly quite proud of. And the third and probably biggest challenge, I'm in partnership with Bloomsbury Publishing. Bloomsbury Publishing are producing a series of encyclopedias on social justice education, 10 volumes. And I'm with a former doctoral student of mine, Amna Pasha. We're editing the one on global education and learning as part of that series. And that's a massive undertaking, because it's going to have 100 entries from people from all over the world. And the reason I'm raising that, not just because I think it's quite exciting, but challenging, but actually it demonstrates the journey that I feel, the field that I'm involved with, been involved with. When I set up the centre in 2006, it was very much on the margins of what we were doing, not that central. And now we have this very growing international network. And one of the things that I do is I chair this international network of academics and researchers in the field of global education and learning called ANGEL, the Academic Network of Global Education and Learning. And it has about 900 members around the world. And it's from that network these books have emerged, really, in some way, if shape or form. So I feel that one of the things that I wanted to do in 2006 was to develop this international network. And what is interesting is that never has there been greater interest in the field that I'm involved in today. There's 10 books a year published on the theme of global citizenship, apparently, people told me the other day. There's sense in which sustainability we know is very popular in a whole number of different fields and areas. I think to me, the sense of which, you know, the field now and the area that I'm involved with, what we've got to do is how do we not only capture that, but how do we ensure that it's disseminated and owned beyond into the wider education community amongst teachers and young people, that they themselves are aware of and the opportunity to learn about these issues, and it doesn't just end in sort of rarefied academic box somewhere. And that to me is how we, to me, it's almost about coming back full circle, because I went from working civil society organisations to help to train teachers in this field through NGOs to setting up working with policymakers to research, because that was what was needed. Now I think we've got to say, how do we use this evidence to inform and enthuse just some teachers on the ground and young people generally to be involved in these areas? And that's where now some of my current work within UCL is how we bring sustainability much more into the life of students' life. And I've been involved in UCL sustainability strategy because how do we bring those things back together in it again? And I think that to me is the biggest challenge that I see in the next few years.
But what an exciting challenge and what an amazing journey you've been on in terms of seeing global citizenship and sustainability evolve over this course. I think it's been absolutely fascinating to hear your story and also how your research is going to have an impact in the real world and also in those schools with those teachers on a global level as well. So thank you so much. It's been great having you. Thank you. You can follow Doug's Twitter, Development Education Research Centre, at IOE_DERC, that's DERC, to learn more about his research. Some of what we've covered today is also available in the episode notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, we have an archive of 17 past seasons. Search IOE Podcast to find episodes of Research for the Real World, as well as more podcasts from IOE. Oh, and a quick favour before you go. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, we'd really appreciate it if you could please give the IOE podcast a rating. 5 stars would be nice. This will really help us spread our reach about such important work. I'm Jo, and thanks for joining.
Research for the Real World is produced by IOE Marketing and Communications and IOE Research Development. The theme music was created by Rob Cochran. Tatiana Sotero-Diaz is the series advisor, Amy Leibowitz is the series producer, and Jason Ilagan is the executive producer of the IOE podcast.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.